Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we have an exciting show for you today. I'm excited to have with me here Dr. Dheeraj Goswami, who is an assistant professor of anesthesia and critical care medicine. He is a pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesiologist. He had quite the route of training to get there. I'm going to let him tell you about that, but he's going to talk to us about pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesia. So we're going to do an overview of a kind of basic intro to that subspecialty, which is a fascinating one. I always remember when I was a resident and I had a day in the OR doing just a regular case, not a cardiac case, with Dr. Anil D'Souza, who was at UCSF at the time. Really great guy. And I remember him telling me that there's just nothing more fascinating than pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesia. And so I think this will be really interesting for folks to hear a little bit about what it is. So Dheeraj, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Jed. I definitely agree with your Dr. D'Souza. It's one of the best things that that I do. I really, really enjoy it. So my training background is a little unique.
Yeah, tell us, how did you get where you are?
So, you know, if you were to tell me that this was a path I was going to go on 10 years ago, I would never have believed it, or 15 years ago now, where I started in pediatrics, in pediatric residency. And then I had an experience during pediatric residency where I did some anesthesia time and really enjoyed it. And when I decided I wanted to do my ICU fellowship here at Hopkins, there were a number of people that did dual training. And what I mean by dual training is that they worked in the operating room as an anesthesiologist as well as the ICU. And I really felt like that was a path for me. So then I ended up completing a PICU fellowship, starting anesthesia residency. Then went and did Peds Anesthesia Fellowship and my Pediatric Cardiac Anesthesia Fellowship and Pediatric Cardiac Critical Care Fellowship at Texas Children's in Houston. And then I returned here after double-digit years of training have been back now for a few years.
That's great. And so lots of training. Now, let me ask you, is all of that necessary for someone who wants to do pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesia, or can you do it with a piece of that but not the whole thing?
Not at all necessary. There are a number of different options that one can go into to do pediatric cardiac anesthesia. You know, the history there is very interesting in that the focus, you know, back when the specialty was new, was primarily adult surgeons doing and working on pediatric patients, and therefore adult anesthesiologists working and caring for pediatric patients. That kind of transitioned when we had the adult surgeons focusing on having a cardiothoracic fellowship. All these cases then being done primarily at children's hospitals, and then a relative transition to their care from adult-based specialties to pediatric-based specialties. There are some still adult pathways where people do adult cardiac anesthesia and then practice in some form some pediatric cardiac cases, but as a whole, the pathway that most people arrive to is doing anesthesia residency, doing a pediatric anesthesia fellowship, and almost at every major institution now, there has to be some extra time, up to six, some do 6 months, up to a year of pediatric cardiac anesthesia fellowship time.
Great. And is that a, it's not an ACGME fellowship, right? The additional, the cardiac time. So that's kind of like an apprenticeship model almost. You just spend a lot of time working with pediatric cardiac anesthesiologists.
It is not, it's not ACGME accredited, but there are relatively established rules. I shouldn't say rules. There is literature out there that states the cases that you should do, the experiences that you should have. And people that have done this for years feel that that should be the requirements for you to become part of that group.
Right.
But it is not at all ACGME regulated.
Okay, great. So if you want to both take care of these kids in the operating room and then follow them and take care of them in the PICU, on a cardiac PICU team, you would need to do what you did, right? You have to have the PICU fellowship. You have to have the anesthesia cardiac piece. But if you just want to practice pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesia in the operating room, you don't need the PICU and the PEDS part.
You do not need that extra time at all.
Okay, great. So a lot of different options out there. You've certainly completed the full gamut, and you, I know, enjoy what you do on both ends. You do still work in the PICU, right?
Yeah, my clinical time is probably split, if you were to look purely in kind of FTE percentage, probably a third and two-thirds, with a third being in the PICU or ICU, CVICU, and two-thirds being in the cardiac OR of some sort.
Great. So let's talk about most common procedures that you do. So when you think about pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesia, what are the main things that it encompasses? What makes it different than just pediatric anesthesia? Obviously, it's because we're operating on the kids' hearts. But what do you think of as the most common things that you do on an everyday basis?
Well, generally all pediatric cardiac surgery are going to be done on children with congenital diseases. And I say that in general, that's just the majority of cases by far are going to be patients that have some sort of congenital lesion. The most common of these are relatively benign cases, and then, the ASDs, the VSDs that will sometimes close on their own, sometimes need repair. And they are, as I said, the most benign in that they're relatively short procedures. They have relatively low morbidity and certainly almost zero mortality. And so they're kind of our bread and butter easy cases that we see consistently, that when they're on our schedule, we kind of breathe easy and get done without too many issues.
And are these getting done because the kid is symptomatic, or are parents given the option, hey, this might close on its own, but if you want to just go ahead, we'll fix it? Or how do they arrive in the operating room?
Well, the good thing is that we have enough data now that can kind of tell us which ones are going to close and which ones aren't going to close and at what time they're going to close. So generally, for those basic ones, there are some that are likely to close based on where they're located and what type of lesion they are.
Okay.
And there's others that, no matter how small they are not going to close based on how they were formed.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. And is this are these evaluated with echo, with MRI? How do they?
Generally, all echo findings.
And do you do TEE? So let's back up. Adult cardiothoracic anesthesia is pretty much synonymous with transesophageal echo. Unless there's a contraindication, every case is going to have an echo. Is that true in your world too?
Generally, that is true. There are some neonatal cases where the patient is actually too small to get a TEE. And there are some cases where the benefit is just not there, meaning that you can evaluate just visually whether things are going as you want it or not. And then if they're not going as you want, you can do an epicardial echo, which would be one that's sterile that's actually sitting on top of the heart, which you can evaluate. Now, TEE is a little variable in the pediatric cases, and I say that because these are anatomically, as we discussed, incorrect hearts.
Right.
And therefore, from a pediatric perspective, to be pediatric TEE certified for congenital heart disease, you have to be a cardiologist.
Okay.
And a pediatric cardiologist. However, the majority of us are at least somewhat comfortable and basic TEE certified, or many of us, I should say. Many of the cardiac anesthesiologists are basic TEE certified or have at least some, I wouldn't say expertise, but some skills with the TEE from that perspective. But we are not the ones, like in adult cardiac anesthesia, that are actually billing for the TEE itself.
Sure. So you have the skills to be able to use it. You can use it to help you guide your anesthetic during the surgery, but you're not doing the pre or post-op echo that's then getting billed to the patient.
Not the bill. Certainly not the bill. And in terms of if, you know, they're a little late and it's a simple case that I can show them and we can move forward with them doing, you know, with the pediatric cardiac group doing cardiology group, I should say,
right.
doing the actual billing and the report for the echo after that.
Right. Yeah. But most of your cases, you're putting an echo in.
Yeah, most of the cases, we're putting the echo in for evaluation. This kind of goes back to, you know, the cases that are most common. Like I said, they are, you know, all anatomically, you know, variable cases. And they can, you know, the majority of our cases are going to be in small children.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, a lot of neonatal cases then beget later cases, meaning that once you've done one repair, oftentimes these children will need subsequent repairs, especially when you are discussing a patient that needs a single ventricle route, which we can discuss at some time. But the majority of those cases are done as children.
Right. Yeah. And so can you give me an approximate, I mean, what percentage would you say of your patients are under a year versus older?
Yeah. So under a year, I think we've evaluated this that are toddler or below, about 60%, I think, are one or less. So majority, I believe, are one or less.
Okay.
Certainly majority majority are three or less.
And what about we're seeing more and more adults who living to be adults who have congenital or were born with congenital heart disease. Do you and your group do the anesthetics for those patients when they come back as a 25 or 30 year old?
So it depends on where you are and the expertise of the institution. So, you know, one of the benefits at being at Hopkins is it's integrated in that the adult and pediatric size it's very easy to move back and forth in between them. So we don't necessarily need to do those cases because we have adult colleagues that are very comfortable doing adult congenital.
Mm-hmm.
At other institutions, depending on what cases they are, the peds cardiac group will do the cases. And whether it's bypass or whether they're coming because they're very complicated congenital disease and they're coming for a non-cardiac surgery, the pediatric folks will do those cases all the time.
Gotcha.
And I would say in general, the pediatric majority of adult congenital heart disease nowadays, because once again, we refer kind of back to what we were saying before, are done by pediatric cardiac surgeons. Their locations are primarily at pediatric focus institutions. Therefore, they're going to be done by pediatric anesthesiologists.
Great.
Not at all places, but at most.
Right. Okay. So you said the majority or the you know most common cases are the benign ASDs and VSDs. Let's move into a little bit more of the kind of complicated cases that you might see. Not that these can't be complicated, but you know what are some of the different physiologies that you see in your patients that we're just not going to see in your typical adult, even adult cardiac case? And what do some of those cases look like?
So when we talk about things, I generally look at the heart flow in series and in parallel. And so for a typical person, me, you, a typical child, they are in series, meaning that blood is flowing from A to B to C to D and cannot flow any other way.
Right.
In a congenital patient, or many congenital patients, their blood flow is in parallel, meaning that it has a choice of going either A or to B. And so oftentimes we have to figure out whether we want it to go to B whether we want it to go to A, and then how to alter the physiology to make blood flow in one direction or the other.
Right. Okay. So that's really interesting, and I want to revisit that. Is there, can we talk about some lesions as being hypoxic lesions and others as not?
Yeah. I think, you know, we talk about children with cyanotic heart disease and acyanotic heart disease.
Okay.
And as a whole, if you have cyanotic heart disease, it does mean that you have some sort of intracardiac shunting occurring. And all that means is that there is blood that is having to decide between A and B at times. And because of that, some blood is going backwards, some of that, not, I shouldn't say backwards, but some blood is going against our typical perspective of blood flow, and therefore mixing is occurring, meaning deoxygenated blood is coming together with oxygenated blood and then being ejected out of the body. So.
Great. So it might be helpful to think about, maybe let's walk through one example of this, and so we can get some specifics as to what these A's and B's are and everything. So, you know, maybe you tell me, but I think we could talk about maybe a kid who's born with hypoplastic left ventricle.
Yeah.
So what does that mean, and what does their physiology look like, and then what do we do about it?
So hypoplastic left heart is a syndrome, and what I mean by that is that there's varying degrees of and areas that are affected, but simply it just means that you have a very small left-sided structure, and that can be at the level of the mitral valve, the aortic valve, the left ventricle, the aorta itself, but usually some sort of combination of all of the above. Now, because of that, when they are born, they have essentially an inability to get systemic blood flow.
Which is incompatible with life, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So if something were not done in a relatively short period of time, and that short period of time can be variable, in a relatively short period of time, they would die.
Right.
And the way that they live for that short period of time is that in utero, we all have a PDA, and that is...
And that's a patent
ductus arteriosus. Mm-hmm. And that is allowing blood flow in utero to bypass the lungs because you haven't taken a breath yet and
right.
go out to the rest of the body.
And that's the connection, let me try to remember here, but I believe that's from the pulmonary artery to the aorta. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what in utero, I just want to make sure I've got this in my head here. So the right heart is pumping blood into the pulmonary artery just like it always does. But we don't want all that blood to go to the lungs because the lungs have super high resistance because they haven't opened yet. There's no air in them. And so we want a conduit. So that blood, instead of going to the lungs all the way through the pulmonary artery, it goes through the ductus arteriosus over to the aorta and then out to the rest of the body.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's there for everybody. Then you're born and it's supposed to close.
It's supposed to close. Now, obviously, if you don't have any ability to get blood out to your aorta, and that closes, you're going to die. So it just depends on what. Now, in this case, for a hypoplastic patient, we use prostaglandins to keep that duct open. We allow blood flow to be ejected into the lungs. And then, once again, physics-related, resistance-related, depending on what has higher resistance, the blood will flow in one direction or the other.
Right. So this is a patient who needs that blood. So all their blood is going to get pumped by their right ventricle out into their pulmonary artery.
Yes.
Because they've got no left ventricle.
Exactly.
So if it all goes there and it all goes to the lungs and then comes right back to the right atrium, we've just got a circle with nothing going to the body. Yeah. So the keeping the ductus arteriosus open, like you said, and this is a common board question, is how to do that. And like mm-hmm. you said, prostaglandins. Do you remember the exact one you guys used?
It's PGE2. It's, so.
Great. Yeah. PGE2. Yeah. I think that even they may get that specific on these questions. So prostaglandin E2 is going to keep it open. And then that blood, some of it is going to go to the lungs, but some of it is going to go through the PDA over to the aorta and now can go to the whole body. So essentially keeping that open allows the right ventricle to pump blood to both the lungs and the body. And like you were saying, and I think one of your main jobs is to help regulate the resistance, because that's how you're going to decide how much goes to the body and how much goes to the lungs.
Yes.
And so how do you do that? How do you control that?
So once again, these are concepts that are you know, across all fields, which is great, but they're kind of focused more on the pediatric field and certainly on the pediatric cardiac field. But it's the balance between systemic vascular resistance and pulmonary vascular resistance. And I think in general, these are topics that people are relatively comfortable with, no matter what they do. But in pulmonary vascular resistance, we are affecting oxygenation. It's the most powerful pulmonary vasodilator we have. In terms of constriction, we're talking about CO2. In terms of systemic vascular resistance, we're just going to either vasodilate or vasoconstrict. And all those things that come together will balance your blood flow out. We obviously are looking at the overall oxygenation because, as you said, if you're not getting any flow systemically, you're just going to have 100% sats. The more and more you are balanced, the more and more you're going to have a sat around in the low 80s because you have 100% coming from your lungs and the extraction is going to be 30-35%. So you have things that are coming around 60-65% from your body, and therefore your oxygenation sats systemically will be in the low 80s if you're in a perfect 1-to-1 QP to QS. And what I mean by that is flow to the lung versus flow to the systemic in terms of blood flow.
And so is that what you're shooting for? Sats in the 80s, low 80s?
You really want things to be into the low to mid 80s. That is really giving your heart the least amount of work that it has to do.
And so this is really, now we're hitting on where this is completely different,
yes.
Right? I mean, a sat in the low 80s for an adult in the absence of some kind of congenital heart disease is an emergency, of mm-hmm. a major problem emergency. And that's what you're shooting for. So that's very interesting. And then let's talk about where you're measuring that. So, you know, we often you hear about preductal, postductal sats. Are you doing that, and what does that mean?
Well, pre and postductal sat is one assuming that you have a duct that's working. And so when you have a preductal sat in a, let's say, a patient that was just born, you're talking about the saturation of the blood flow purely ejecting right out of the RV because the duct is usually closer to your left subclavian. It can be before your left subclavian, after your left subclavian, but the blood flow going to your right subclavian is all going to be ejected from your LV through your aorta. So it's just that LV saturation, and it's all the oxygenation that's coming from the lungs going into your LA. So that is kind of isolated oxygenation there. But when you have an open PDA, once again, you could have shunting going in multiple different directions, right? So if you have a postductal sat that is lower than your preductal sat, what you can assume then is that there's some flow that's coming from your RV out to your systemic system and causing mixing at that location and desaturating. Now, if you have mixing that's occurring in intracardiac, so in a hypoplastic left heart, your mixing is really occurring at the RR. In other congenital lesions, many of them are occurring intracardiac, meaning at the level of the atrium. And in that case, it doesn't matter where you are checking because the mixing is occurring there.
Right.
Your saturations are going to be the same regardless where you check it.
Right.
But that's what we mean by pre and postductal.
Great. So do you put a oxygen sat monitor on the right hand and the left hand? Is that how you figure this out?
Usually, because the subclavian can be a little variable place, I usually put on the toe because then I know for certain that it's truly postductal.
Gotcha.
But yes, in essence. Yes.
Okay, so you've got a right finger sat for your preductal. Mm-hmm. And like you said, any blood that is being pumped out of the left ventricle is going to go there before any mixing from a PDA.
From a PDA, yes.
So that is why it's your preductal sat. It means it's before any effect from a PDA. And like you said, if there's no PDA, then this is not an issue. And then if you have one on, like you said, the most definite way would be to have it on the foot or the toe. And then you know that's after any mixture from a PDA. So if there is blood coming from the right heart up to the pulmonary artery, it's going to be deoxygenated because it hasn't made it to the lungs yet. going over through the PDA into the aorta and then down to the foot, that would be low. So if you have a PDA, presumably your preductal sat in your right hand is going to be higher than your toe sat because it's getting deoxygenated blood mixed in through the PDA going to the foot. It's going to be lower.
Exactly. And I think just to make it all make sense, the time where you see this the most is when you have a baby that is just being born. And when we talk about the transitions from fetal life, because you take a breath, your oxygen tension then comes in, your PVR falls, and then what's supposed to happen is that PDA is supposed to close,
right,
and now all blood flow is supposed to go through the lungs. There are certain processes that happen, and this is not truly associated with congenital heart disease, but certain things with severe pulmonary hypertension, meconium aspiration, other pediatric-focused diseases that occur at birth that will delay that process from occurring. And that's the way to see how severe it is, because it'll tell you how much blood flow is actually going into your lungs versus going through your PDA.
Great. All right. So let's go back to something you said, which is that the main ways you control the pulmonary vascular resistance are regulating oxygen and CO2, oxygen being a pulmonary vasodilator and CO2 being a pulmonary vasoconstrictor. So this is really interesting because in adults, we really only do the other side, which you also do, which is, for example, maybe giving some phenylephrine to increase systemic vascular resistance, or maybe giving some nitroprusside, nitroglycerin, nicardipine to decrease systemic vascular resistance. You guys do that too, and we'll get to the specific agents you use in a minute, but you also then have this other side you're regulating. We maybe do that a little with an adult with pulmonary hypertension, where we maybe, you know, we try to keep them from being hypoxic or hypercarbic. But you're doing it, I think, much more actively. So tell me a little about that. How are you actively managing pulmonary vascular resistance in these kids?
Well, we will generally keep them on room air as best as we can, because in a hypoplastic left heart patient, it's really systemic blood flow that you want. So any increase in pulmonary blood flow, you're stealing from systemic blood flow and you're making the heart have to work even harder.
Mm-hmm.
That's already doing two ventricles worth of work.
Right.
So we try to keep as room air as possible. There, back in the day, there was the use of less than 21% oxygenation, which we actually don't do anymore, and I can explain that. Most places don't do that anymore, and I can explain the thought process behind that in just a second.
Sure.
And then we actively, aggressively try to change CO2 and try to balance the acidosis that you occur that can obviously have an impact on heart function with the PVR that increases to improve systemic blood flow. And by using CO2 instead of less FiO2, it improves. There were studies that showed that it actually improves mixed venous, which obviously is a sign of it's an oxygen extraction sign, but if you're extracting too much, it's a sign that your heart's actually struggling. So it balances that approach and actually improves lactate levels, so improves how we evaluate oxygen delivery.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it seems to me like if you have a choice of either decreasing the oxygen you're putting in, which might cause more blood to go systemically, but that blood's going to have less oxygen in it, or you can use CO2 while still having a reasonable amount of oxygen, better to use the CO2. That's the argument.
Yes.
Okay. And it sounds like the data would back that up. So to use CO2, do you just do what we do in adults, which is if I want the CO2 to go up, I just decrease the respiratory rate or tidal volume, or do you actively inject or have the perfusionist actively inject CO2?
So things can get kind of tricky. And, you know, remember that the places where these children are taken care of first is in the ICU for 3 days. So as their PVR, that's the acute process where PVR drops and the most optimal timing for surgery. So oftentimes some of those decisions have been made for us, meaning mm-hmm. that they're already going to be intubated, they're already going to have their respiratory rate controlled. And so, you know, when they are in the ICU and are well taken care of and are coming to us with as optimized as possible really makes my job a lot easier and what I would prefer to do for myself when I'm in the ICU. But in the operating room, we just translate from there. We'll mm-hmm. just do very similar things. We can bleed in CO2. It is something that is possible and feasible. I've only done it a handful of times. I've only needed to do it a handful of times. Mm-hmm. But it is something that we will do. Most of the time, I feel that if we control the situation, what I mean by that is you intubate them. You paralyze the patient so that you can control the breathing, and you gently increase the CO2 to optimize PVR. That is usually enough for the majority of these patients to control their QP to QS balance.
Great. So let me ask you, since we talked about hypoplastic left heart kids, just, you know, again, let's maybe just give me an overview of the surgeries. I believe they have a series of surgeries. Mm-hmm. Just tell me what they are and, you know, kind of what's being done as a general overview.
So the initial surgery that for a hypoplastic left heart is a Norwood procedure.
Okay.
Generally, Norwood BT shunt, Norwood Sano. Some patients do also this hybrid procedure, but we'll talk about the things that are the most common, which is a Norwood procedure. And what they do there is they essentially create a neo-aorta out of some portions of your pulmonary artery and a graft to make a whole new arch and aortic system and a new coronary systems at times. So now your blood flow is going out an aorta that the surgeon created. And then now you can imagine, well, now something has to be done with pulmonary blood flow.
Right.
So it's much easier to balance blood flow when the problem is lack of pulmonary blood flow, as we kind of discussed before, than when it's a lack of systemic blood flow.
Right.
So the two general options people do is something called the BT shunt, modified BT shunt, which is, you know, a connection between your subclavian and your right-sided PA. In general. Mm-hmm. And then the other option is a Sano shunt, which is an RV to PA conduit and is another type of essentially Gore-Tex that is connecting your RV to your PA.
Okay. So basically what we've done is created a way for the blood to get systemic with this neo-aorta, because without that, you can't live. And then added a shunt so that some of that blood can get to the lungs.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And now, you had mentioned before, but important to point out, obviously this blood has to mix in the heart since there's only one outflow from the heart. And so these kids have to either be born with an ASD or VSD or have one created, right?
Yeah. ASD generally is a better is where blood is going to actually mix because the diastole and systole are going to be alternating. So then you get essentially a mix back and forth of those of that
gotcha.
Blood flow.
And there isn't much of an LV anyway.
Exactly. So, yeah. So it's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So they have to have an ASD. They're probably all born with an ASD.
Yep.
Or if not,
or it has to be created.
It's created. Yeah. Okay. So the blood mixes in the heart. It all goes out. What now is the neo-aorta. Some of it is going to go through the shunt to the lungs, and the rest of it goes to the body. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's step one. When do they come back? Oh, that's done when? 3 days of life?
That's done usually 3 to 5 days of life.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then when do they come back?
So then in terms of coming back, now what's important here is that now with it, regardless of whether they're hypoplastic or not, any single ventricle patient, so any patient that we feel for whatever reason is not going to be able to have a right and a left ventricle will go down this path of some sort. So the second surgery is something called the Glenn and the Glenn procedure. And there's numerous perturbations of the Glenn procedure, but as a whole, it is bringing the SVC, so your all blood going from the top of your body and connecting that to your pulmonary artery. So then you actually have disconnected your pulmonary blood flow from your systemic blood flow. So your pulmonary blood flow is all coming from your head. Your systemic blood flow is still mixed in that you still have venous blood coming from your lower part of your body, mm-hmm. mixing with the blood coming from your upper part of your body. And so now you can imagine that your right heart was having to do two ventricles worth of work before. Now it's having to do something less than that.
One and a half,
whatever you want to say. Yeah.
Okay, great. So we've taken, so now all the blood from the upper part of the body is draining straight into the lungs, essentially, to the PA and then to the lungs. Then goes from the lungs back to the heart, but it's now oxygenated. And then the bottom half of the body from the IVC still goes into the right heart deoxygenated. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's step two. And then what's, and that's done when?
That's done between 3 to 6 months.
Okay. Yeah. So they're a little bigger, yes. Probably a little easier to operate on at that mm-hmm. point. And then they come back for step three at some point?
Yes, and that's usually done 3 to 5 years of age, and that is called a Fontan procedure. And once again, there's numerous perturbations of the Fontan procedure. But as a whole, it is then bringing the lower part of blood flow and connecting that now to your pulmonary artery, making all pulmonary blood flow a passive blood flow process, and then now allowing your right ventricle, or in other situations, your other single ventricle, being your systemic ventricle and ejecting blood out to the rest of your body. So it is now, in general, now when we talked about parallel and series circulation, a Fontan that has no other holes in it is a in series system, meaning there's no way for it to go in other directions. It has to go A, B, C to D.
Right. And the interesting thing about this is that you now have your pulmonary blood flow, since there's no right ventricle pushing blood to the lungs. It's just a totally passive system,
yes.
Right? So it's completely dependent on pulmonary vascular resistance as to how much blood actually, you know, is able to flow.
Yes.
And so these are patients when they come back now, later in life, right, for any kind of surgery, be it an appy or whatever, who you have to be very, very careful, because if their PV, if their pulmonary vascular resistance goes up, they may have get into big problems very quickly.
Yeah, and those patients can be very complicated, and it would be a whole nother webcast.
Yes, and we definitely won't get into all that. But that, let's at least say, if I have that patient show up on my schedule, I'm calling you.
Yeah.
All right. So good. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about is bypass. So there's a pretty standard for adults having cardiothoracic surgery, cardiopulmonary bypass. There's obviously a little slightly different ways it can be initiated, but you know, in general, it's the same. Is it similar for kids, or is it different? And how is it different if it's different?
Unfortunately, it is very different in children, and there's also so many institutional variabilities and practice patterns, and so it also makes it pretty difficult to study the different practice patterns, because, you know, or really even study the field as a whole, because people do things so differently. So to talk about some of those differences, one, there's so much variability in age and disease processes that the act of going on bypass for some kids is very different than for others. For instance, we'll talk about, you know, in adult cardiac as a whole, oftentimes if we're looking at the CABG as our standard procedure, mm-hmm. the CABG is something external to the heart, and so rarely do you need to decompress the heart fully to allow for an adequate repair. But almost all of pediatric cardiac surgery is intracardiac, and repairs that need to occur with the heart stopped. And mm-hmm. so that's one of the big differences just between adult and pediatrics. But then the way people do that, the way people stop the heart, their focuses when they stop the heart, what and how they want to keep blood flow going to the brain and other parts of the body when they do stop the heart, is, you know, from institution to institution can be 180 degrees apart.
Okay.
And like I said, it's been very difficult. No specific way in terms of doing that has been proven to be better than any other.
Okay.
And so that's why there is such variability.
Is it, do some patients end up getting cannulated peripherally and others centrally, or is it all central?
So generally it is all centrally, but some patients, they'll do something called antegrade cerebral perfusion, which mm-hmm. is that they'll, of some form, cannulate one of the neck vessels, so whether it be the brachiocephalic, being able to go to the carotid during periods of circarrest, which means that the heart is completely stopped, blood is removed from the body, and you just have blood going to the brain. So the antegrade cerebral perfusion is just blood going up the carotid, across the brain, coming back down, and then being drained. So right. you're only perfusing the brain. Some places believe in that. Some places don't. They go circarrest, and they give you a time period that you're going to have, and then you best be done by that time because you have an increased risk of neurologic injury afterwards. So there is a lot of variability in terms of maybe not necessarily how you go on bypass, but how you perform bypass from institution to institution.
Okay, that's really interesting. Presumably these kids are all cooled.
Generally, so anything done intracardiac as a whole, if you're going to do cardioplegia, will be cooled to some temperature, sometimes 32 if it's going to be a quick procedure, sometimes 28 mm-hmm. if it's going to be a moderate procedure. And then if you're going to do any form of circarrest time of any sort, or if you're going to stop blood flow to the body in any form, generally we will go down to 18, 19 degrees.
Okay, great. So are there certain complications, that are kind of, they come up frequently or that you think about, in your cases in general? And I'm curious because I'd say by far the most common complication, so to speak, in adults would be hypotension. And the most common thing we do about that is give a little phenylephrine or give a little ephedrine. I could imagine situations with your patients where that may not be the right move, to treat hypotension. Because that will also increase pulmonary vascular resistance, and maybe they're not someone who can tolerate that. Or maybe it'll increase systemic vascular resistance too much, and you'll get more blood flow to the lungs, and they can't tolerate that. So, you know, are there well, let me start with hypotension. Do you treat hypotension differently than we do, and how do you think about it?
Yeah, you know, so I want to be careful here because there's opinion and then there's stuff based on fact. And much of what I'm going to talk about, if not all of what I'm going to talk about, is really based on opinion.
Okay.
Because there's very little data that supports any sort of use of one pressor over another in any pediatric population.
Sure.
So in saying that, then, how I tend to run my decision-making is by physiology, because that's then, if I don't have any data, then at least I'm going to have some thought behind what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So then what comes, you know, with the next part of it is understanding the physiology of the patient. Because as you said, you know, if a patient has severe pulmonary hypertension, then, you know, like you said, phenylephrine, epi, many of those drugs can alter pulmonary vascular resistance. And do we consider vasopressin or other drugs like that that might have less of an impact on mm-hmm. it? Would those be a drug that you could use? And so there are times where I'll use that, where I'll use vasopressin as an infusion or other sorts because of my concern of pulmonary hypertension.
Yep.
In that setting. There are also situations where I know with a neonate coming off of bypass that their cardiac sarcoplasmic reticulum is, to simply say, calcium dependent, meaning that you just need a higher concentration of calcium mm-hmm. Than you would for a non-neonate for it to get the same effect. And so there are times where I'll use calcium as an infusion mm-hmm. To try to optimize that cardiac output. But as a whole, then it's not that dissimilar than in the adult population mm-hmm. where, you know, cardiac outputs what we're really treating is low blood pressure. Low blood pressure is a simple equation, and that's for everybody.
Right.
It's cardiac output times SVR. And right. so which one do I think is the problem here? And then that's what I'm going to fix. And that's the benefit of having an echo, is if I can say that the cardiac output, the volume status, everything else is okay, then all I need an SVR drug. If I'm saying, wow, that right heart doesn't look so good right now, then I'm going to disregard some of the other components. I'm going to give that patient epi more often than not.
Great. All right. So what about hypoxemia? Because that's definitely different. We've already heard that you're shooting for low 80s in some of these kids, which is clearly different. If you fall below that, options, certainly if an adult gets hypoxic, we're going to give them more oxygen. That may not be your approach, right? So you may actually deal with systemic or pulmonary vascular resistance as a way to affect your SATs, not with the concentration of oxygen you're giving. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, it's the most common cause, and when I was always a resident, or especially when I was in the PICU, your response of hypoxia is always to turn up oxygen. But I remember an attending telling me, did we just move to Everest? You know, because,
right.
You know, did all of a sudden the lack of oxygen causes hypoxia?
Right.
And so obviously you want to do something that's going to fix something acutely, but in any situation, I think it's important to realize that if you're hypoxic, it isn't because you lack oxygen. It is some other issue.
Right.
It just becomes a little bit more pertinent for us because there are severe consequences, much more severe than just some potential oxygen toxicity.
Right.
As we discussed, if we modify the oxygen on there, we could really be causing a lot of systemic issues in a number of these patients. So because the consequences are so high, we truly have to evaluate what we think the causative effect is. And that's where you have to make very quick decisions. You have to look at all the data you have, and it's much like when you get you're sitting for your oral boards and someone's asking you a question, you have to go through that systematic approach where you're looking at your end-tidal CO2, you're potentially asking yourself to get a gas to be able to evaluate whether you're overventilating or underventilating. You have to look at your systemic perfusion. You have to look at your pre- and post-ductal gases depending on what type of perfusion is occurring in that situation. So, you know, there's such a variety number of cases, and that's why it's important to understand what the case is, what you're doing, what you're repairing, what the patient is going to do afterward, and what to expect afterwards. That way you're not having to think through this. It becomes much more natural to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great. So really quickly, and I don't want to go into details here because we've done another episode on this, but you're managing the acid-base status of your patient. Are you using pH stat or alpha stat?
So in children, I think the data is relatively clear that pH stat is beneficial, and we think that it's beneficial because of improved cerebral blood flow that might improve aspects of neurologic outcomes and other things like that. So I would say that most cardiac anesthesiologists, most cardiac programs would agree that in children, pH stat is better, and that's what we use.
Great.
At many children's institutions, because they also do adult congenital, will do pH stat
for all their patients.
For all their patients, and it's more to have a consistent approach, and with generally there being likely minimal outcome concerns in patients in congenital cardiac patients, even adults, because they're younger and have less concern for stroke and other risks. That's usually the approach that most people take.
Okay. And I'll just say to listeners that I did a whole episode on pH stat versus alpha stat. That's episode 20. You can find that at acrac.com if you want to check that out. All right. So, Dheeraj, when you're thinking about kind of the basics, induction, maintenance of anesthesia, paralysis, are you doing anything drastically different in these kids, or is that pretty much the same?
So compared to adults, it can be different. Now, one, peds is always – pediatrics is always going to be a little bit different than adults because their reserve is so much lower. Mm-hmm. Their FRC is lower than the closing capacity. So oftentimes right away once you start induction, they're going to start desaturating quickly. So because their FRC is lower than the closing capacity and now they are desaturating, you now have a patient who – has a very delicate balance between systemic and pulmonary perfusion, based on the things that we've just discussed before, and then a heart that's having to do two ventricles worth of work. So any further stress you put on that heart could potentially cause a very quick and significant decline, even leading to an arrest. So it does raise the pressure and the intensity of the situation significantly. So the way we kind of approach that, there are, once again, some variable thought processes. I would say the majority of cardiac anesthesiologists would put on some amount of oxygen in that situation. Mm-hmm. With the understanding that you are putting a stress to the situation, but you're allowing your fellow, your secondary provider, resident, whoever it might be, a little bit more time to allow for intubation. So from that perspective, it is a much, I think, probably one of the more intense situations, mm-hmm. Especially with someone like a neonatal case,
yeah.
where, as I said, you know, it's even more delicate than an infant or a toddler. In that situation, it can be pretty scary sometimes.
Yeah. So. I mean, I remember even healthy neonates desatting very, very quickly back when I was a resident doing pediatrics. And so I can't imagine with congenital kids, you know, at 3 days of age.
And then I think, you know, in terms of drugs, like you said, in terms of induction medications, we'll use very similar medications that you've used in sick patients, in any other sick patient, meaning that the hope would be that you cause homeostasis. You don't want things to go too high. You don't want things to go too low. You would be very happy if they're sitting exactly where they were when they came in. And so your goals of medications can be an opioid based. It could be ketamine. It could be etomidate. Mm-hmm. But understanding the risks and benefits of all the drugs, and then continuing to move forward. Yeah.
Do you avoid succinylcholine?
In neonates, I think it makes no difference. So as a whole, the black box label for succinylcholine came primarily because there were some kids that had Duchenne's that you didn't know and you gave sucks to, and then they are maybe not just Duchenne's, other diseases as well, and they had a hyperkalemic arrest.
Right.
So as a whole, I will use succinylcholine in children when it is the most appropriate drug to use. Mm-hmm. In this situation, I don't usually use succinylcholine because I don't think that there's that much of a benefit because I'm going to be ventilating them. They shouldn't have a full belly.
Right.
So I should be able to do this in a controlled, even fashion. And so I don't feel like I need to use sucks here. But I would if all of a sudden we were trying to mass ventilate after induction and the process wasn't working or there was another problem, I would give sucks without any doubt, any question in my mind.
Okay, great. Well, we've covered a lot of great stuff. Anything you think we've left out that we should – do you want to comment on?
No, I don't think so. Just once again, I want to thank you for having me here. I hope this was a little helpful for everybody. It's a complicated subject, I think there are some things that you can learn from these patients that you can take to any situation that you're in.
Yeah, so. Great. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Dheeraj. And certainly, if people out there have questions, want to know more about pediatric cardiothoracic anesthesia, post comments on the site. We can get Dheeraj's comments on them as well, and everybody can learn from people's comments. So go to acrac.com and check it out. Dheeraj, thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
All right, that was fantastic. As I said, check out the website, acrac.com, ACCRAC.com. Leave a comment. You can, of course, always get a hold of me at acrac@acrac.com. And if you are a fan of the show, consider going to iTunes, leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show when they are searching for an anesthesia-related podcast. Also, if you're interested in helping support the making of the show, please check out Patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACCRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. It makes a big difference. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, really helps, and we are greatly appreciative. All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Dheeraj Goswami, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, What you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.